Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is September 18th, 2006. Today's Elder Hostel session is entitled, If You Want to Know Geology, You Have to Know Rocks. Our presenter is Don Coberly. Let's listen in.
That's here, so
right on time.
Everybody needs, or everyone is welcome to, a copy of this set of handouts. As well, what everyone needs are two rocks, one coming around in this milk crate, so take one, pass it along, and then one coming around in this plastic bag. The milk crate has kind of speckled looking rock in it, the plastic bag has kind of red pink looking rock in it, so you need one of each.
Is speckled and red pink scientific terminology?
Okay.
One in every color.
And you'll also need one of these paper towels. So.
But I can do this.
That's the level of sophistication we're going to talk at here. The format of my sessions, as Cliff alluded to, is a little bit different than his. It's more didactic, is that what you said?
That's what I said, yeah.
Which I think is me standing up here talking and you guys listening and then asking questions. I was going to say it was going to be a more formal lecture, but that's not the way it's going to turn out at all. So, Okay, yes, sir.
We need one more thing. You got rock and towel and paper and scissors.
Marilyn, what do you need?
I was the lady and I didn't get the granite. They're still being passed around.
Yeah, there's.
Okay, I'm going to follow that sack. Thank you.
Okay. All right.
We need the pink ones over here.
Pink ones back over here.
Ready?
I think so. You should be.
Some of the pink may be a little bit gray too, so don't be confused by that. But it won't be speckled. All right. You bet.
But I got a strange skin tone than you already.
All right, does everybody have a handout booklet, a speckly rock, and either a pink or a gray rock? Excellent, that's what you need to go. Okay, everybody take a deep cleansing breath. Where's Marion when I'm doing this? Okay, as I think I talked about yesterday in our original meeting, we're going to do two different sort of sets of things. For the first 3 days, we're going to talk about very, very, very basic geology. Today and tomorrow, we'll be in this room talking, and then Wednesday, we'll be out hiking. And then on Thursday, I'll do a PowerPoint presentation related to the mine site, and then on Friday, we'll take a hike over there. My format for doing these sessions is to start at 10:30 and talk 1,000 miles an hour for 40 minutes, take a 10-minute break, and then come back and do the last 40 minutes. I have my watch set with an alarm. It will go off at 40 minutes. If I can finish what I'm talking about in a minute or less, I will finish. If not, I'll stop right there, and we'll take our break, and I'll figure out what I'm going to say for the next 40 minutes, and then we'll come back and we'll go from there.
I have a question.
Yes.
I was just going on the front of this, and it said if you want to pursue it later, don't do it here. Go somewhere else.
That's not precisely what it says, and here you are skipping ahead. First off, I don't mean to get particularly crossways with Dr. Cliff about his talk this morning. But when he said something about spending all this money on healthcare and maybe it could be used for something else, and I said something about studying geology, and everybody laughed.
That's dumb.
If you study geology, a lot of that will be done outside. Is being outside a good thing? If you study geology, I think of geology mainly as solving puzzles. If you solve puzzles, you're staying mentally active. Is staying mentally active a good thing? Third thing is, most geology, sooner or later, gets done in community. You may go out on your own and look at geology and look at rocks, but sooner or later, you're going to have to talk to somebody else if you're going to publish it. Or you're going to talk to somebody and say, hey, I think this is what's going on over here. Do you think that's the case as well? And if you do that before you publish your paper, and the person you're talking to goes, ooh, that's not such a good idea, you don't have your paper published and it makes no sense and everybody laughs at you. So there's a sense of community in geology. Is that a good thing? Yes, it is.
Who's and hisses?
The last thing that came to me after I'd had these first three put together is most serious geology is done with beer. Now, we're not going to do that as beginning geologists, but if you get more into geology, you'll find out that it's sort of like beer and geology go together like, you know, baseball and hot dogs or something. Is that a good thing? So my thinking is studying geology is probably a fairly good thing to do. So I think we should spend more money on it. But that's just a personal opinion. So what I want, this packet relates to today and tomorrow mostly. And then you can either bring it with you in the field on Wednesday or leave it home. We'll talk more and sort of on the fly in the field. And if the weather's bad, we won't want to have this with us. I want to read this thesis that I have, that I've come up with after doing these sessions a few times, that says, at its essence, geology is an observational science. I differentiate geology from other sciences like physics or calculus, which are calculation sciences or experimental sciences. Geology is an observational science. To do geology, you have to go out and you have to see it, or you have to touch it, or you have to taste it. I'll tell you about that in a minute. Geology is an observational science, that it is based on observations of rocks, which we'll do today, landforms, which we'll do in the field on Wednesday, and which we'll look at some pictures tomorrow, and the relationship in space of rock units to one another. If we find certain rock over here and we find different rock over there, that should tell us something. That's part of the puzzle-solving nature of geology. Once observations have been made, once we've looked at this rock and said, well, we'll describe things about it today, what does that tell us? What are the clues? What can that lead us to? And that's where you guys can already observe better than I can, and some of you are better at it than me, or as well as I can, and some of you are better at it than I am as far as observation goes. What I know more about from geology is, based on that observation, what does that mean? What can this rock tell us about the conditions under which it was formed? Once observations have been made, it is possible to make interpretations or advance hypotheses, which is a scientific term for an educated guess, about the geologic makeup and history of an area. That's what we would do if we were going to do geology of this area. We would look at the rocks that were here and we'd see how they relate to one another, and then we would make up a story about what is the geology of the Holden area. Which leads me to why, going now, skipping ahead to what the goals are and the assumptions. We could do a very good job in 3 days or in 5 days of learning the geology of the Holden, of the Railroad Creek drainage, which is where we're at right now. And the next time you were here with your friends, you could impress them because you knew all that geology. But what happens if your next Elder Hostel trip is to Sedona, Arizona, or to the Bohemian Alps of Nebraska, or Florida, where my parents happen to live. And if that geology is different, then you'll be scratching your head just like everybody else will. Whereas if we focus on the very basics of geology, on the next Elder Hostel trip you take, the things we'll talk about for the next couple of days should apply there as well. So you can impress people there. So that's my thinking. So since you're here, you have some interest in geology. Or if you come back tomorrow, I'll think you have some interest in geology. You're not going to spend your entire life here in the valley, so you're by necessity going to have to do your geology someplace else. So that's my line of thinking to make this as practical as I can for at least part of our time. On Thursday and Friday, we'll talk about the Holden mine site, and unless you go to some other mine site, that stuff won't have real wide application, but it will have a lot of application here. So I'm trying to cover sort of both ends of the spectrum. If you pursue it more lately, or more later, you're going to obviously do it someplace else. So that's my line of thinking. What I would hope we could do over this 3 days is get you revved up enough and learned up enough that you could take a book from the Roadside Geology series. I don't know if you've seen these. These are available in both your local bookstores and the national chains. You can get them online. I've got Washington and Oregon here, or Washington and Colorado here. Here's Oregon. There are 35 or 40 of these available. There, in fact, is a Roadside Geology of Nebraska book, which I thought was funny. I wouldn't think it would be very thick, but maybe there's more to Nebraska geology than I realize. I like these books very well because they're in that middle ground between being too cartoonish and too simple, that doesn't do us any good at all, or being too bloody complicated, right? Well, there are textbooks. I have a textbook, Geology of California, which once you've studied geology for 3 or 4 years, you can get all the terminology and you know precisely what they're talking about. But for you guys, it doesn't do any good at all unless you're going to get really, really serious about it. These books, the format of these books is, here's the road going from point A to point B. And you're going to take Highway 20 from Corvallis, Oregon, out to the coast. Is that Highway 20?
Yes.
You say, I'm going to go visit Cliff and Gay, and after that we're going to drive down to Newport and go to the coast. So what does it say along Highway 20? And you can look at the geology along Highway 20 and say, this is what we're going to see. So you can pull over to the side of the road, and here's a picture that shows what it is, and it gives you a little description, and now you can take your hammer with you and knock some rock off and do some more geology. So this is a very good format, and the level of sophistication is good too, because it's neither cartoon or too complicated. There's usually a glossary in the back that takes more of these precise geologic terms and relates those to things that you guys understand. So that's what I'm hoping at the end of a couple of days of talking together, that you could take one of these books, whatever your next road trip happens to be, and say, I'm going to go to wherever my bookstore is and pick that up, and we'll go and maybe we'll see something that we are interested in and we'll pull over and stop and look at it. So that would be what I would hope you would get out of these first 3 days of doing these sessions together. I said that geology is an observational science. Usually we think about using our eyes, but we can use all our senses when we do geology. What are our other senses? Our sense of hearing. In the business world that I work in, one of the things I do is, and what I do on for the highway there near Cliff and Gay's house, is they're going to reroute the highway. They care very much about what the physical properties of the soil and the rock are. And here are sizes of material, and when we look at clay and silt, these are the smallest sorts of particles. Silt is a little bit bigger than clay, and so if you take some mud that has some silt in it, and you make a paste out of it, and you hold it up to your ear, you can hear this sort of scratchy noise, whereas if it's all clay, you don't hear anything. So you can use your sense of hearing to help you learn geology. By the same token, I was up on the tailings pot yesterday getting these rocks for us. It was one big rock before I got to it, and now it's a bunch of smaller rocks because I was whanging on it with my hammer. And just by noting the sound, the ringing sound of the hammer on the rock, you can tell whether you have a really competent piece of rock or a kind of weathered piece of rock. A really fresh piece of rock will ring almost like a bell, whereas a really rotten piece of rock will thud like you were hitting on a piece of wood. And in fact, there is a more scientific version of that called a Schmidt hammer, which is used in serious geology all the time. And it's got a piston in it, and you push the button, and the piston hits the rock and then rebounds back. And the more it rebounds back, the harder the rock is. Well, after you've used a Schmidt hammer for a while, you can tell, and it has a scale of 1 or 0 to 100, where 100 is really good rock and 0 is really bad rock. Once you've used that thing for a day, you push the plunger and you hear it, and you go, oh, that's going to be a 65, and you look, and it may be a 60 or a 70, but you can, just by hearing the rock, when you hit it, you can tell something about how competent the rock is. So you can use your sense of hearing to help you in geology.
When you said good rock or not good rock,
I would be thinking about that in sort of construction mode, where if you're going to build a building, you want to build it on solid, fresh rock.
So a denser.
Fresher, less weathered rock. So that good or bad, that's a really good point. Again, I've got a different hat on in that moment, thinking about building on top of it. Sense of sight, we can look at a rock. Sense of hearing, we can listen for it. Sense of smell. When we go up on the tailings pile on Friday, back in 2000, we had to dig a pit into those tailings. And when you expose those, the tailings are the big orange piles of stuff. And that orange that we see is essentially weathering, rusting of the iron in the tailings. Those piles are not orange all the way from top to bottom. There is this rind of orangey material. When you dig into it 4 or 6 or 8 feet, it's kind of blue-gray because that material hasn't rusted yet. That material has a very distinct sulfury smell to it. Like when you used to have a cap gun and you would pop off caps, that kind of smell that you would get, that was the sulfur in the powder. You can get that same sort of odor from up on the tailings pile. The same way that if you're drilling and you drill through an old wetlands area, you get that kind of sewery or garbagey smell, the decomposing organic material. So when I'm out drilling and doing work, again, professionally, one of the things I'll do is smell the core to see if I'm in a zone like that. Or in the environmental business, you can smell if you're drilling through a zone at an old gas station that's gotten contaminated. That's where the gas is. Well, you can tell that pretty easily. So you can use your sense of smell. What other senses? Sense of feel. The same thing with that silt versus clay idea, where if it's all clay that you have in a mud, and we go out and do this on the walk, maybe everybody pick up a little bit of mud and we'll rub it between our fingers. If it's all clay, it's almost like butter. Whereas if it's got silt or sand in it, it'll be kind of gritty. Which brings us to our sense of taste, which we can do the same thing with. That same silt, you don't really taste the rock so much as you experience the texture of it. You can take some of this mud and you put it on your tongue and you rub your tongue against the back of your upper teeth. And if it's got any grit in it at all, you will know where, and now you'll know there's silt or sand in that mud, where if it's all clay, it's very, very buttery. So you can use all your senses to do geology with. That's the point here. Again, we make those, the first thing we do is we make observations. We look at a rock and it has certain characteristics. And we don't need to care what the name of it is. whether this is a granite or a granodiorite really is irrelevant at the level we care about. And I've been studying geology for 17 years now, and in my professional career, this being a granite or a granodiorite doesn't come up very often either. It's not all that important. If you want to know this, you can go to your local community college or your four-year college and take a semester-long class on this thing, and if it doesn't kill you, you'll know that this is a granodiorite, and we can talk about the degree of formation of the crystals, and we can learn a little bit more, but it's, again, is that a good use of your time? If you're totally interested in that, that class is available to you. Please.
I'd like to go back to the smelling. We have all smelled sulfur springs. Now, explain what, you know, I think I know, but give it a shot for me.
What... why is there sulfur in the water?
Yeah, because it comes...
Well, that water that you get in the sulfur springs is usually hotter than normal, right?
Yeah.
And so as that puddle or that vent of water, that stream of water is connected somewhere down deeper to a heat source, and then as it rises because it's hot, because it's got a hotter temperature... it is more able to take solid material off the walls as it's coming up and incorporate that sulfur into the water itself. It comes to the surface, it bubbles up. Now that sulfur mixes with oxygen and goes into your nose, and you go, oh, that's sulfur smell.
Smells like rotten eggs.
Smells like rotten eggs.
How far down is that heat source?
That depends. I mean, it's very rarely on the order of a mile. At Yellowstone, I think it's not like there is a 1,000-degree puddle of rock with 20-degree rock all around it. Mm-hmm. It's hotter and it gets progressively cooler.
Yeah.
So it a mile or something on that range, something less than that.
And then from there on down, it gets hotter and hotter.
As you get closer to the center of the earth, it gets hotter.
The center, and that's where hell is, right? Right.
Well, now we're into the spirituality.
Let's not go there.
Okay. So, what I want to talk about today is rocks. There are three main kinds of rocks, and now we can page four. Oh! After the first page here, there are a couple of other sort of non-geologists. Pages in your handout, I can tell you all about what I think the positive benefits of being a geologist are, and you can say, well, he's a geologist and he's just BSing me. But if Ann Lander says it's true, then I think you can all agree that right, it should be gospel. So you can read through this on your at your leisure about what good folks geologists are. Now that Cliff has been in my class a couple of times, more of his patients are surviving than used to. He's got a better bedside manner. This is he's been nominated for some pretty prestigious medical awards. Kids and dogs like him better. And that's just for, you know, like 1 week a year for 2 years now. This is his third time around, so who knows what will happen. I'm thinking next year a Nobel Prize is just probably. Anyway, and then the next page is from another one of the Gospels. This one, in case, is Calvin and Hobbes. And now we can move ahead and talk about rocks. There are three major categories of rocks, and again, what the last thing... sort of globally that I hope at the end of 3 days we will all be convinced of, I'm convinced of it already, is that geology is common sense. There's nothing mystical or magical or even very complicated about geology. It's a very common sense science, particularly as we all have the ability to observe things. And like I said, some people are better observers than me. Even though they don't spend their time doing enough geology, they're still better at seeing things. That's the first part. The second part is, what does it mean when we see things? That's where I can come in and I can help you. But I will come back to this and berate you for the next 3 days about how common sense geology is, which is why everybody can do it. When we go to a new area to do geology, one of the things I want to do is go find the old farmers, because they've been around for a long time and they've been sitting around and every now and again have a little free time on their hand when they're out driving the tractor, and they know where the geology is and they've spent a lot of time thinking about it. And it's not complicated. It's not quantum mechanics or stuff that I forget that. It's geology. It's common sense. So that's one of sort of the global threads I would hope you would take away from. All right. Let's talk about rocks. Three major categories of rocks. And again, we're not going to get too much into the naming part of it. We're going to try to focus on, we see a rock, what can it tell us? And this is a derivation of what you have in your handouts. The first major kind of rock that we're going to talk about is a sedimentary rock. We all know what a sediment is, or I think we do. A sediment is a solid material moved by a fluid. If you get a cup of coffee and it's down towards the bottom of the urn, you get sediment in your coffee, right? You get old coffee grounds. Those are solid material that have been moved by a fluid. Solid piece of coffee bean that's been moved by a fluid called coffee, and you wind up with it in your cup. A sediment in the geology world, sediment is being moved by Railroad Creek as we speak. There are the solid grains that are being moved by the water. Sediment can be moved by other fluids. What are the other fluids we can think of? Air being one. So solid grains, when the wind blows hard enough, there's solid material that's moved by the wind, right? It's called dust, or it's called sand, if the wind's strong enough. And so now you're out in the desert and you see sand being blown around, and so now that sand stacks up and compresses enough and lithifies, turns into stone, and now you have a sandstone. That solid material has been moved by a fluid called water, called air. The third fluid we can think of is ice. This valley was carved by a glacier. The Lake Chelan Valley, the one that the lake is in right now, was carved by a glacier. And you can tell that because it's got a very dramatic sort of U shape to it. If you see a V-shaped valley, that's a valley that's been cut down by a river. But when you see the big classic U like we have here, we're down in this little flat valley, and you go up that way, and now it's Buckskin and Copper and Dumbbell Peak, and you go up that way, and it's Martin Ridge. We're in a glacial valley. Well, that glacier transported material, ripped it off the mountains behind us as it was flowing down, or rocks fell down onto the glacier, and it got transported down valley. We'll see an example of that on Wednesday. So, a sediment is solid material moved by a fluid. Once it gets lithified, turned into rock, now it's a sedimentary rock. What I've been talking about are these, there again, we go after sedimentary rocks, there is this first sort of break-off of clastic. That's what I've been talking about, these clasts. That's the solid material moved by a fluid. There are also chemical sedimentary rocks, limestone being the one of those that people know the most about, right? Which is skeletons of living creatures that lived out in the ocean that then the creature died and the skeleton sank to the bottom, and you get this stuff stacked up, turns into stone, and now you have limestone. We're not going to talk so much about limestones today since.
Why do they call that chemical?
Because it's the characteristic of that rock is the calcium carbonate that made up the skeleton of the living organism. And so again, it's the characteristic of the rock when you deal with it, either scientifically or if you're going to build on it. That's a thing that you care about knowing, is that that's the source of that rock is calcium carbonate that was incorporated by the creature, the diatom that makes up the limestone.
So the chemical, by definition, is related to a living organism.
I think I'm gonna stick with that for the moment. Okay. The other ones I can think about are diatomaceous earth. That's another single-celled organism that, instead of using calcium carbonate, used silica in its skeleton. Go ahead.
And when say sand turns into sandstone, it lithifies.
Yes.
What makes that happen? How's that?
That happens because you pile more material on top of it over time, and it's that increase in pressure and also temperature. As you get closer, as it gets laid down more stuff on top of it, it gets pushed down deeper and closer to the heat source. So it's usually that increase in pressure and temperature that cause sand grains to become a sandstone. For the clastic sedimentary rocks, which is the thing we're going to talk about most, the rock name is based on the particle size. And here are those particle sizes that I wrote down previously. Let's start at the bottom. Clay, if you turn that into a stone, it's called a claystone. We call that shale more regularly than claystone, but there is a, if you're into technical geology, you might call it a claystone. Go ahead, Cliff.
Just one more question. To convert, say, sand into sandstone takes pressure and temperature. Is there a time? I mean, can we do this in a laboratory? Can you just compress sand to under tremendous pressure and heat and turn it into rock, or does it have to take thousands or tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of years?
That's a great point. We can do it in the lab by juicing up both the pressure and the temperature. In the real world, it takes something on the order of tens of thousands to hundreds of thousands to millions of years for that pressure. It's either you can change it quickly under high pressure and high temperature, or under a little bit elevated temperature and a little elevated pressure, it takes quite a long time. So that doesn't happen overnight. What was sand grains today at the Earth's surface is going to be sandstone tomorrow because there's another foot of sand piled on top of it. We're talking about hundreds or thousands of feet of material that gets put on top, and now there's that weight that can help compress that.
So we're talking about artificial stone, is what?
We could create it artificially.
Yeah, that's right. Or, and sometimes they're for sale in nurseries and so forth as artificial stone. That's what it is.
That, yeah. Again, it can be created quickly,
yeah,
under abnormal pressure,
yeah,
and temperature,
right,
or it gets created slowly under sort of earth conditions. So if we have clay-sized material and we turn it into a stone, we call it claystone or shale. Silt turns into siltstone. Sand turns into sandstone. That's the reddish or grayish piece of rock you have is a piece of sandstone. As you get to these larger sizes, gravel used to be called gravel stone. Now we call it conglomerate, because now it's mixed up, the same thing as a multinational conglomerate. It's all a bunch of stuff that got jammed together. Mm-hmm. And then as you get to cobblestone and boulder stone, there aren't very many real-world geologic situations where that happens, that you can get boulders this big sort of mashed together, because you can't. If you have a piece of sandstone, if you have boulders, I can't bring in a piece of boulder stone because it's too heavy to carry. All right, I just made that up. Okay. If someone comes to you and says, I have a rock behind my back, guess what kind it is? Is it igneous, metamorphic, or sedimentary?
Sedimentary.
Best guess is always sedimentary, because about 70% of the rocks that we can see at the Earth's surface are sedimentary. So always go with that. The odds are with you. One of the things that is good about that, the two rocks that you have, one is a sedimentary rock and one is an igneous rock, and you can look at those and say, well, gee, how can I tell the difference between them? One of the things that you will see, and I've brought magnifying glasses, and a hand lens, which is the geologist's version of a magnifying glass, and you can pass these around and look at them. This is simply a 10-power magnifying glass that has protection on it so that when you're out doing geology in the field, you can protect it and your lens doesn't get all scratched up. One way to help you see the sand in the sandstone is if you'll pour just a drop or two of water on it, and that's why I gave you the paper towel to go with the sand.
And I don't have a piece of sandstone, sir.
I'll give you one. I'll get you one.
Thank
you,
sir.
Sure. You can look at these, and it's going to take a few minutes for... You could be doing this while I'm busy talking. If I say anything important, I'll be sure to remind you. What we'll see, and there's a, I had a little bottle of water that we can, what you'll see in the sedimentary rock, first off, you'll usually see the grains being more rounded, and there will be some space between them that's usually filled in with some sort of cement, either silica or calcium cement. Where in the igneous rock, you won't see too much space between various particles. The igneous rock, we'll talk about that in a little bit, about how it forms. And there isn't a lot of space in between the particles. The other thing that you will see in an igneous rock is some of the fragments may have sort of a geometric shape to them. This is because as the material cools, depending on the chemistry, it may cool in a certain way, where you'll see a sort of squarish or a diamond shape or even a hexagonal feature. That usually indicates it's an igneous rock. You don't see that in a sedimentary rock because a sedimentary rock, again, the grains have been moved, and the first thing that happens is you'll sort of knock those corners off. You don't see a regular or a geometric shape in very many sedimentary rocks. So those are a couple of hints that you can use to try to differentiate with some bigger sediment or more coarse grain sedimentary rocks. It's easier to tell that you're looking at a rock that's made out of grains. I only have one of these because I borrowed it from the Portal Museum, but if you look at this whitish rock that's coming around with your magnifying glass or your hand lens, you'll be able to see those grains are very clear, and again, you'll see them sort of bumped up against one another with some space between them with a little cement in them.
Question?
Yes? Oh, okay, the plastic bag that had the sandstone in it, where might that be?
Where is it? I think they were all gone.
How about
okay. Go ahead, Rick.
I mean this to be a serious question, although it may sound frivolous. If I cannot go into certain national forests or parks and pick things up off the forest floor and move them around.
Right.
Are there any such restrictions on banging on rocks?
At the one place I know about this to be the case is at Mount St. Helens. There is an area from which you cannot remove rock. It's called the Pumice Plain. And there is, you can't remove rock there because so many people have done it that it's there, most of the rock is gone. So I don't know about any other, I don't think there is any reason why we can't go out and bang on rock up here and take it away. I don't
Technically, it wouldn't be a problem.
I don't think that to be the case. Again, Mount St. Helens is the one place I know about. So, does anybody have a question that they can ask and answer in 15 seconds? Please, go ahead.
So sand just means, the term sand is just about size and shape. It doesn't mean there could be, it could originate, particles could originate in tons of different ways.
Absolutely. Sand is a size gradation. That's the only thing it means in strict geologic terms. And there, within that, there are breakdowns of, is it a fine sand or a medium sand or a coarse sand? But that sand-sized particle could be quartz or feldspar or anything else you wanted it to be.
Could be formed in all kinds of different
Exactly. So when people talk about sand, they think about the beach. Well, that the what is that beach sand? Well, we're going to talk about that when we come back from the break. That beach sand is, well, look uphill and find out what the mountains were that were behind the beach, and that's what the sand's going to be. So it could be quartz, or it could be any other, a number of things. In Hawaii, there's the black beaches, which are the lava beaches. All right, 10 minutes. Get out of here, but come back.
Don, I have a rock. It's called sand. Sand rose. It's a cone. There are about four or five of them, and they're formed by, well, they look like roses, but they're called roses, and they're all formed together.
Something that
you know what I mean?
Yeah.
And that I've seen one material that forms that way. It's got sort of petals on it.
Yeah,
that's a mineral. What I've seen is a mineral that forms that way.
Oh, in unique shape.
But are they rare?
Well, fairly rare. It's not a gem, but it's not a piece of rock.
Beautiful.
Yeah, there's a very specific mineral that I know of called rhodochrosite.
Ah, that's it. Yes. You know, my house is full of rocks, but you know, I tried at one time to think of the names. And this is dumb. I don't want to know the names. I just want to feel them and look at them. That's my right brain. I really don't care about anything on the left.
Well, and I don't, again, for 99% of what any of us ever do, knowing the specific technology and we can talk about what they mean,
even on my bathroom,
where they came from, what we can learn from them without someone
specific. Yeah, a long time ago, she had a
yes or no question.
Okay.
She, you know, she had something else, and she had a different smell, but we just don't know that because we're so poor in that area.
Could you find an animal, maybe a dog, that has a superior smell and a good twin?
Yeah.
I mean, maybe another intelligent animal, an elephant or
there's no, I can't think of any reason why that's why.
Well, let me ask a question though, but I mean, assuming, let's just make believe there's copper in this. Maybe it's 10% of this copper.
I don't know. I think it might be able to help anybody use it.
It's got to be in the air, right? So it has to be aerosolized or aerotized or something has to happen.
You'd have to walk along with your spray can on water and hose everything down for the dog to smell.
Well, it would have to somehow be. I mean, I just don't know. I mean, if you have gold and thing, I mean, if the gold not being, or is it? Are there volumes of gold, but atoms of gold just flicking off and flying around in the room?
Well, are they? Yes. Is it infinitesimally small? Is it right? Right. Gold, you know, sublimate, but whatever that is,
so small and in such low concentration. And
right, 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 right.
So I mean, an animal would not be able to sense it unless we're in a reasonable concentration that it would land on a receptor, a neurological receptor, and then
understood.
And so,
or well, I'm just
so if there was gold there, we'd already know it enough for them to smell because we would already have sort of hammered down to it. Maybe. Okay, thank you.
Correct me if I'm wrong. My understanding is that in true natural forests, in the national parks, and that St. Helens is a national park, so that wouldn't fit into that category. My understanding is the difference between national forests and national parks. In true national parks, like the Great Lake National Park or the Olympic National Park, you can't paint anything out or remove any vegetation.
So there are strict
applications. You just can't go there. You can't go to Crater Lake and just stop picking up rocks and things. without getting some kind of you can come out. You can come out the natural forest here and take small pieces and always come bother you. In the same way that you can mine, I mean, the government grants mining to the national forest, but doesn't you can't mine or do anything like that in a national park or in a wilderness. I think the wilderness areas are way out of the same situation. The wilderness area, you can't go in and pick a wildflower.
But it is better.
I don't know if that's. I know that's definitely true in the national park. My feeling is that you probably could pick a wildflower in that
forest.
Up against the wall, you might
look for the rocks.
What's the name?
Well, I have a friend who did work at St. Helens, and now I don't think she rifled the backpack, but if she saw you in a particular promise point, you could have
rocked. Using it rather than.
Well, we were in Hawaii at one of these black cloud retreats, and they were a storm. Everyone knows that you cannot pick up some sand and take it with you. Usual to have to be told that about sunrays how much you have to see. I also spent some days in the Big Island.
Not a Big Island.
I didn't have a national park. There's a Hawaiian national park.
Yeah, on the southwestern tip down there.
Near the big volcano. Well, maybe it's not. I don't know.
It takes a while to get used to
it. I think what they think.
Don?
Yes.
What did you say?
Yeah, pretty soon we'll be gone. You're not going to go by a million visits a year.
So another cause of...
Well, we should take that into some really bright light and look at it.
Oh, that's it.
Let's walk...
Could it have little pieces of igneous in it?
Sure.
Sure. I see your eye.
That's a possibility.
Shifting sands
is a crystal or something. I don't want to say crystal, of course, that's what it looks like to me.
Okay, I have that in my room. Why don't you stop by?
This looks to me like the majority of that waste is quartz.
Look, when I look at this, you can see the
sand.
Take a look at this. You can see how the sands, we talk about shifting sands.
But in this case,
and you can see the pattern of the way that the sand was moved by either water or wind. And then in that one corner on the other side, there's a little, it looks like
you can see those.
You can
separate little.
Yeah, there's these little things that sort of stick out past the edge of the rock itself.
Yeah.
And those are specific kinds of quartz. And then the yellowish stuff in between them is the cement that's holding it together.
I was raised in northern Indiana, and we had sand dunes.
Well, and that's the way quartz starts.
There used to be one big lake there, right?
Exactly.
So they could be.
Maybe your past.
if that quartz had moved very far, that's what we're going to talk about right after the break.
Did you give me this little piece?
If that quartz doesn't move very far, it still might have some of that hexagonal to it. Whereas if it gets moved a long way,
talk about shifting sand. If you take a real close look,
it gets rounded. If it gets bashed a long time, all of those angles get knocked off and it gets more round.
So what are we talking about? It's particles, water, see how...
Well, or we look at their shapes, the more angular they are, the less distance you can move. Whereas the
longer
now
any of the angles, right? If you put something in a rock tumbler, it goes a rock tumbler. It knocks all the angles. So the longer time it spends in the rock tumbler, the more it turns out. So we can use that sort of criteria to say how far has this material been moved from where it started, or how long were it tumbled. This is from either Colorado or
your observation.
I use this in the business world. You put in a well on here, put the tube in there, and this material This is very, very turbulent because it's very clean. Clean ended. And now the water can go from the rock through this into the well. So that's this is that ties into the geology of the Colorado. Somebody's got Washington.
The community, how we talk,
Syndrome brings that out in so many aspects.
When there's
it's all, well.
And the beer, Ted, we love beer.
Okay, I'm not making that up, am I?
You are, no. He does, he don't drink wine, but he's not a coffee drinker, not a tea. But do you really enjoy it?
This is really me in my face.
All right. Let's do another 40 minutes and then go have lunch.
Yeah, we're gonna have a sandwich.
Okay.
All
right. As I had said, all right, no more geology jokes.
Okay.
The only one gets to tell geology jokes is me. We talked about sedimentary rocks being the most abundant part. One of the reasons I think that's helpful is because we can usually tell more from a sedimentary rock than we can tell, or we can tell different things based on whether we have a sedimentary rock or an igneous rock or a metamorphic rock. And this is in your notes. Three things to infer from sediment or clastic sedimentary rock. The first thing is the source area geology. If we look in our piece of sedimentary rock, let's do a thought experiment, which is a scientific way of make-believe. I'm here working. Me and my buddy Jamie are here together. This is my friend Jamie. He's now 38 years old. When we were here in 1997, he was 31. And our boss comes to us and says, I want to know the geology of the entire basin up here, Big Creek and Holden Creek and up near Cloudy Pass and all of that. And both of us go, excellent, what a cool job. And Jamie goes back to his room and he gets his backpack on and he larders up 3 weeks' worth of freeze-dried stuff and he takes his tent with him and he heads down the road. And through the next 3 weeks, he's out climbing around on all the mountains and he gets rained on and he likes that and he eats crappy freeze-dried food. And he gets beaten up and the bears chase him. And at the end of 3 weeks, he comes back here and as he's been taken out freeze-dried food. He's been throwing rocks in the back of his backpack. And he just has a great time. I'm a little older than Jamie is. I'm a little smarter in some ways. I like sleeping in a bed. I like drinking coffee with the Lutherans. I like ice cream, which they have pretty much every night. So what I do is I go down to the footbridge here and I jump in the creek and I start looking at rocks. And I look at, and some of them look a certain way, and so I take one of those and I throw it out on the bank. And I look at, oh, here's another one. I throw that out on the bank. And the bell rings, and then I come back for supper. And I go to bed, and I get up the next day, and I do that the same thing. And I might go up to Big Creek, which is the first creek up here on the left, and I would do the same thing up there, but it's a short walk, and I can certainly be back in time for coffee break. The next day, I would go up to Holden Lake and do the same thing. I'm going to let the river do all the hard work for me and let it bring the rock to me. Jamie's going to go do all this stuff and about get killed three different times, and he's going to enjoy that, but that's fine. So the point there is the rock that we see in Railroad Creek right now, where does that rock come from? Well, we've got mountains all the way around us, so it probably comes from somewhere in this valley. And if we wanted to get more serious about it, we could do sort of a statistical look at, instead of picking out just the one rock, I'm going to pick out 1,000 of them, and I'm going to clump them up into groups, and at the end of the day, I'm going to have 500 of a certain kind, and 200 of another kind, and 5 of another kind. And I'm going to say, well, I guess most of this drainage has whatever I've got the 500 pieces of. It's got, you know, I've got a lot of this kind of rock that's in the river. Well, I'm going to say a lot of the stuff that's uphill from us in the drainage is like this. So we can tell that, in this case, from the sediment in the creek, or we can tell that if we get a sedimentary rock, we look at where did that rock come from. It can tell us something about the what used to be uphill from it, or used to be what in the area that has drained to where that rock is found now. Does that make a little bit of sense?
That makes a lot of sense.
Okay, here's another. I just came up with this, so this is a new analogy that I'm trying on you today for the first time ever, and if you don't like it, then I won't ever use it again. This is the analogy to the question of how do we know what the original Rocky Mountains looked like? The Rocky Mountains that we see now are the third version of mountains that have been there. How do we figure out what the first version of the Rocky Mountains look like? They're all gone. How do we know? So here's my analogy. Dr. Cliff is my personal physician. And we get through with my annual physical, and he does all the tests, and he hits me on the knee, and my leg does what it's supposed to do. And we sit down, and we have a little conversation at the end, and he says, you know, Don, all your tests look good. You seem fit. You seem marginally mentally there as much as we can hope for, but you know, you're a little heavy. You maybe just a few pounds, you know, you'd be healthier if you'd lose a few pounds. Okay. And he said, and you know, we've worked together and seen each other enough to know that I know you really like those powdered sugar donuts, you know, the little donuts with the, every time I see you got those bloody powdered sugar donuts. So if you just cut those out, next year when you come to see me, you're going to be like 15 pounds lighter and you're going to be in perfect health. Okay, Dr. Cliff, I promise you no more powdered sugar donuts for the next year. The next day he sees me. You've been eating powdered sugar donuts again, haven't you? Oh, no, I haven't. You see any powdered sugar donut? He said, how does he know that I've been eating powdered sugar donuts? Because he can see the crumbs, right?
Yeah.
Okay. How do we know what the original Rocky Mountains looked like? Because we can see the crumbs. We can find the crumbs anyway. If you go to Golden, Colorado, There is the music amphitheater called Red Rocks.
Yes.
Or if you go to Colorado Springs, there is the park called Garden of the Gods. Mm-hmm. And there are those very dramatic red rocks that have been tilted up on end. And what happens was the original Rocky Mountains came up as mountains. And what happens when a mountain gets built? It starts to erode because it's out in the environment. And that stuff gets pushed off or falls off to the sides. Mm-hmm. Gets transported by creeks like Railroad Creek. And then gets deposited. And so as the mountain gets, it continues to get pushed up. So the more material gets shed and it gets lithified, turned into rock. And at some point, because the pushing up stops, now it finally erodes down until we have a low flat land, and that rock forms and becomes lithified. And then millions of years or hundreds of millions of years later, a new set of Rocky Mountains gets pushed up, and these things that used to be laid flat now get pushed up on end, and we see them in Golden, Colorado as Red Rocks Amphitheater, or in Colorado Springs as Garden of the Gods. And now we can go take our rock hammer with us and bang a piece of it off, and we can look at it and we can say, huh, here's this material, and we can age date it, and we can say, all right, this, these pebbles that we see, and if you go to Red Rocks, you'll see this very clearly, it's a conglomerate. It's stuff that has gravel size, kind of, you know, skipping stone size rocks in this finer matrix, so you can tell what's in there. So that's one of the things that we can tell. What was the geology of the source area? We can tell that from looking at a clastic sedimentary rock. Go ahead, please.
I never have figured out, but what makes a rock go, I can understand it settling down, but what makes it go up?
What makes it there has to be some geologic force, and the primary geologic force that we think of or that we recognize now through the new idea of plate tectonics is that the interior of the earth is very hot. The exterior of the earth is cool enough for us to stand on right now. When you have hot in some places and cool in other places, that heat gets transferred through cycles, and it's that upward motion of molten rock that is in sort of the middle part of the earth that then causes forces that are big enough to push the continents around, to push California on the San Andreas Fault. So that there is a constructive force that comes from the interior of the earth, pushes the plates around, pushed India into southern Asia. And as those two things push together and continue pushing on each other, they bulge up, and now you get the Himalayan mountains. And that is balanced over geologic time by the destructive force of erosion from the environment.
When you're going driving up here from Chelan, they have the rocks on the side of the road where you could see the layers in them, and they're real wavy and curvy, the layers are.
Yes.
But every once in a while, you'll see a layer of a light beige color. And
yes.
Most of the rocks are dark, but you see this light beige color. It's like a ribbon flowing through the other rocks.
Uh-huh.
And what is that?
That's either a metamorphic, that entire piece of that entire sort of wall of rock has been metamorphosed. That's a third type of rock, which means it's been changed by metamorphosis. We think of the caterpillar, butterfly, or whatever. That's not rocks, I don't understand. Say that again. Larva.
Larva.
Caterpillar, butterfly, right? Metamorphosis means
cocoon.
Change.
Yeah.
So when we talk about a metamorphic rock, we talk about a rock that's been changed. Again, the things that we can think about at the surface or near the surface, what things change, and pressure and temperature are those two things.
What's going on at Mount St. Helens?
What's going on at Mount St. Helens?
That's growing in the middle.
That's growing. That's a different process. That's more lava coming or being, getting closer to the surface.
It has nothing to do with that.
Say again? a different process than metamorphosis. In metamorphosis, what happens is that rock gets heated to enough of a temperature that it's a little bit fluid. Okay, these glass windows, we think of them as being solid. They're actually fluids. They're just really, 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 really,
really,
really thick fluids. And we know that because if you go to Europe on your next elder hostel and you go to the old churches where the windows were formed in 1200, they're a little thinner at the top and a little thicker at the bottom because just under the force of gravity, that fluid that has been moving.
Just like us.
So if you heat up a rock, not very hot, but you keep it hot for a million years, it can flow a little bit, and you'll see those wavy sorts of features in them. But that's skipping ahead. Igneous or sedimentary rocks, source area geology. Look in the rock. This rock that we see here, if we could look at these grains closely enough, we would say, oh, here are, I assume they're mostly quartz sand grains. Wherever the material came from that formed this rock, it was probably fairly quartz rich. There are other sedimentary rocks. There's a piece up in the mine museum that we could look at that shows lots of different types of rock fragments in it. And now we could do better work to say, okay, where we find this rock, this is the source. There's some shale fragments in there. So that had to be uphill from where we find, or up valley from where we found this rock. Go ahead.
So you could have sedimentary rock that was made out of sediments that were originally metamorphic rock.
Absolutely. There's there's a thing called the rock cycle where each of these, you take a sedimentary rock and you compress it and pressurize it, and now you make it into a metamorphic rock. Mm-hmm. You take a shale, which is a sedimentary rock made out of mud, and you compress it, and now you make a slate out of it, mm-hmm, that we make pool tables out of. It stays under pressure and temperature long enough, and it remelts, and now it's an igneous rock. Right? Mm-hmm. That igneous rock cools below surface. The geologic processes we talked about that push it back up, push it to the surface, and now the environment starts working on this, knocks off pieces, puts it in the stream, and now it's a sediment. That sediment is made up of igneous rock. So each of the, we could draw the arrows, we could make a triangle out of this with sedimentary, igneous, and metamorphic, and talk about each of those sort of transitions. You could you take this rock, and even in this phase, even in this state, you pressurize it and put some temperature to it, and you can metamorphose it, and now it will stretch out. If you're pulling on this and you heat it a little bit, it'll stretch out so that these black flecks will get elongated, and you can tell now the direction that they were pulled. Like a piece of silly putty, right? You put the silly putty on the comic and then you pull on the two sides and people will get real long, or you pull up and they get real tall. Mm-hmm. So, yeah, it's each can become the other.
Mm-hmm. In the end, they don't know who they are.
That we're all a little bit of something.
Yeah.
Okay, the second thing to talk about under clastic sedimentary rocks is distance to the source area. Think about whether we're close to where the rock started or far away from where the rock started. On the day, if we listen right now, and there's a big rock fall up in Copper Basin, what does that rock look like the day it fell? The whole thing comes down, wham! You have stuff that's Volkswagen size, and you have stuff that's sand or silt size. And it's all angular and it's all jagged. Now, what would happen if we would take a truck full of that and put it into our magic rock tumbler that we got over here that can have an entire truck full of rock in it at one time? And we throw it in there, and we turn the rock tumbler on, and we come back 10 years from now. What does that material look like compared to what it was the first day? Well, all of the big pieces have smashed into each other and have knocked each other into smaller pieces. And the smaller pieces have kind of gone in through the spaces of the big pieces, so there's not much change has happened to them. And all of the big, long, angular pieces, all of the stalactite kind of looking pieces, have been busted. So you, over time, you take what was all different shapes and all different sizes and all very angular, and you make it into all smaller variety of grain sizes, and you make it more rounded. And the other thing that might happen, particularly if you had water in there, is you make some chemical changes to the rock so that the less resistant stuff is now gone. It's in the soup. And the more resistant stuff is left. And you take that to the extreme, and now you get what's left in these jars that I'm passing around. What's the most... We think about what sort of geologic or environment is the same today as it was yesterday, as it was 100 years ago, as it was a million years ago. How about the beach? You go to the beach and 32 waves an hour or 62 waves an hour, 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, 52 weeks a year, 1 year for the last million years, or 100 million years, there's been a beach somewhere that every day just pounds the living poop out of a bunch of rocks. So when you get done with a million years of buffeting of a rock, that's what you get left with. And this is material from either the Front Range of Colorado or up north in Wyoming, and it gets mined in almost that form. This hasn't been washed very much, and it hasn't been sorted. And what's left there is all the same size, and it's all pretty rounded because it's spent a million years or 100 million years in the rock tumbler. And what's left is quartz, which is the most resistant of any of the minerals. And I use that in my professional work. When you put in a monitoring well, you use that material to sort of pack around the well so that the water will come in, because it's coarse-grained and it's very clean, and it will help water get to the well. So that's the far end of the spectrum of the rockfall. If we find a sandstone and it's more rockfally, if it's more angular pieces and more different sizes, that we call the sorting. The more various sizes you have, that's poorly sorted, whereas those jars are very well sorted. It's all the same bloody size. Mm-hmm. If you find poorly sorted and angular material in your sandstone, it hasn't been transported very far. It hasn't spent very much time in the rock tumbler. Make sense? Mm-hmm. Whereas if you see what's in the jar, it's been weathered to death. It's been tumbled and tumbled and tumbled over a long period of time. So if we found a sandstone made out of that material, we would say, oh, that stuff's been around a long time. It's been in the rock tumbler for quite a while. Go ahead.
What did this stuff start as?
Hard to say, because so much of it is gone. You can't very well tell. In that case, the analogy I just came up with doesn't work very well. If you could take this rock, and over a million years, what would be left would be that, or 100 million years, simply because the black stuff in here would weather away, and so we wouldn't see it anymore. There's quartz in this rock, which when we weather it for 100 million years, that's what we come up with. It's the only thing that would still be left. Go ahead.
When it's fine like that, is that an indication that it's been... undergone a long period of time, or it's come a long distance, or some combination?
I would say it would be a combination of both. We think of both of those together. I don't know that there are things that are in the rock tumbler for a long time but don't move very far. We sort of imply distance with time. Okay. So those are the things I want to talk about for
the quiz.
For plastic or plastic rocks, sedimentary rocks. Go ahead.
I hear you say classic, but you're spelling it plastic.
Plastic. C-L-A-S-T.
And that's a technical term for your profession?
A clast, is that, do people know what a clast?
Okay, all right, I got you.
So clastic means made of clasts. Okay, we could do a quick quiz. And I know you're all going to do fine on this.
Oh, yeah, sure.
That first color picture that you have in your set of handouts. In reality, this is a concrete wall that someone had saw cut a doorway into. And I was working near that and then started looking at the wall and thinking, this makes an excellent example of... We know to say this is a sedimentary rock is a little bit phony, but as an observational idea, I think it's perfect. What can we observe from looking at this picture as far as those things that we've talked about? The angularity. Are most of the fragments that we see here angular, meaning very sharp edges, or are they rounded, like that stuff that we see? There's the majority of them are rounded. There are some angular fragments. If we were going to be more serious about this, we could look at, do we see one type of rock that we think is fairly common? We could look at this whole thing and count up all the big rocks and say, okay, there's 120 big rocks in here, and 65 of them are this sort of dark-looking stuff, and 20 of them are the kind of buff. We try to not look so much in geology at color. In this case, it's about all we have to start with. What's the variability from the biggest size we can see to the smallest size we can see? The biggest thing we can see, I don't have a scale in here, but if this is about true life, you know, that's 4 inches of concrete. So the biggest rocks that we can see in here are kind of 3/4 inch-ish looking stuff. So it's not... It's certainly not this, right? We see rocks, there are rocks big enough that we can see, and then we look at the matrix, and even with our hand lens, it would probably be a little bit too small. So again, we would just be writing down these observations. Largest particle size, 3/4 inches. 80% rounded to sub-rounded, which is kind of rounded. 15% subangular or angular. Some of these pieces, if we were going to look at this more thoroughly, there's a kind of a yellow piece down in the bottom middle that has a kind of a white rind around it. If we're looking at that in the geologic sense, we would think that that would be weathered somehow. That would be something we'd write down in our notebook. And at the end of the day, after we all got back after observing this, we'd all sit around and have our community time and drink our beer, and we'd say, well, what do we think this means? Now, in this case, we know what it means is that this was the mix they put together to build the concrete wall. But if we were going to do the next page, this is an actual real-world geology photo, not one that's made up by a concrete wall. And we would go through precisely the same process. And that little shiny thing is a quarter, so there is a little bit of a scale here. So we know what a quarter size is, and we would do...